Chapter 16. Do you remember the square outside the consulate in Bayonne? Schwartz asked. The refugees would line up in columns of four, but after a while the ranks would disintegrate. The refugees would panic and block the entrance, weeping and groaning and fighting for a place. I remember, I said. There were place tickets that entitled you to stand outside, but the crowd blocked the entrance just the same. When a window opened, the moaning became a screaming and a howling. They had to throw the passports out of the windows. 100 arms shot up. The crowd looked like a forest. The girls had gone off to bed except for two. One of them, who was rather pretty, sauntered over to our table with a yawn.
You're funny. All you do is talk and talk. It's our bedtime now, but the cafes are all open if you want to talk some more.
She opened the door. White and strident, the morning burst in. The sun was shining. She closed the door behind us. I looked at my watch. The ship won't be sailing today, said Schwartz. Not until tomorrow night. He saw that I didn't believe him. Let's go and see, he said. After the silent brothel, the noise at first was almost unbearable. Schwartz stood still. A crowd of children ran by, carrying baskets full of fish. Watch them all running and shouting, he said, as if no one were missing. We went down to the harbor. The water was choppy, a cool wind was blowing, the sun was harsh and without warmth. Sails fluttered in the breeze. Everyone was furiously busy with the morning, his work and himself. We drifted through the bustle like two withered leaves. You don't believe the ship isn't sailing until tomorrow? Schwartz asked. He looked very tired and worn in the merciless light.
I can't, I said. You told me that it was sailing today. Let's ask. It means too much to me.
As much as it did to me. And then all of a sudden, it means nothing at all. I did not reply. We walked on. A desperate impatience seized hold of me. Life called me with its cries and colors. The night was over. Must we go on conjuring up shadows? We stopped outside a shop covered with posters. In the window, a white sign announced that the sailing had been postponed until the following day. I'm almost done, said Schwartz. I had gained a day, but in spite of the sign, I tried the door. It was still locked. 10 or 12 people were watching me. From all sides, they came a few steps closer as I pressed the door handle. They were refugees. When they saw that the door was still locked, they turned away and pretended to be looking into shop windows. You see that you still have time, said Schwartz, and suggested that we have some coffee in the port. He drank the hot coffee quickly, cradling the cup in his hands as though to warm them. What time is it? He asked.
7:30.
1 hour, he murmured. They'll be coming in an hour. He looked up. I didn't want to tell you a sob story. Is that what it sounds like?
No.
What does it sound like?
Like the story of a love.
His features relaxed. Thank you, he said. He pulled himself together. The awful part began in Biarritz. I had heard that a small ship was putting out from Saint-Jean-de-Luz. There was nothing to it. When I arrived back at the pension, I found Helen lying on the floor. Her face was convulsed. A cramp, she whispered. It will pass. Leave me alone. I'll go for a doctor.
No, doctor, she panted. I don't need one. It will pass. Come back in 5 minutes. Leave me alone. Do what I say. No, doctor. Go away, she cried. I know what I'm doing. Come back in 10 minutes. Then you...
She waved me away. She was unable to speak, but her eyes were so full of a terrible, incomprehensible plea that I left. I stood in front of the house, staring at the street. Then I inquired about a doctor and was told that a Dr. Dubois lived a few streets away. I ran to his place. He put on his things and came along with me. When we returned, Helen was lying on the bed. Her face was damp with sweat, but she was quieter. "You've brought a doctor," she said as reproachfully as if I had been her worst enemy. Dr. Dubois approached the bed with little mincing steps. "I'm not sick," she said.
"Madame," said Dubois with a smile, "suppose we let the doctor decide that."
He opened his bag and took out his instruments.
"Leave us alone," Helen said to me.
I left the room in confusion. I remembered what the camp doctor had said. I walked up and down the street, staring at the Michelin tire ad on the garage across the street. The fat man made of tires became a dark symbol, compounded of entrails and crawling white worms. I heard hammering from the garage, as though someone were making a sheet iron coffin, and all at once I knew that this threat had long been with us, a livid background against which our life had taken on sharper contours, like a sunlit forest against a wall of storm clouds. I don't know how long it was before Dubois came out. He had a little goatee, and I guessed that his practice consisted chiefly in prescribing mild remedies for the coughs and hangovers of the summer people. That mincing walk of his threw me into despair. This was the dead season in Biarritz. He was grateful, no doubt, for any ailment that turned up.
"Your wife,"
he said, and paused. I glared at him. "Just tell me the truth, or don't say anything." For a moment, a thin, very touching smile changed him completely. "Take this," he said, pulling out a prescription pad and writing something illegible. "Go to a drugstore and have it filled. Make sure they return the prescription. You can use it as often as you have to. I've put that down." I took the white paper. "What is it?" I asked. "Nothing you can do anything about," he answered. "Remember that. Nothing you can do anything about." "What is it? Don't be so mysterious. I want the truth." He did not reply. "When you need it, go to a drugstore," he said. "They'll give it to you."
"What is it?"
"A powerful sedative. You can only get it with a doctor's prescription." I took the prescription. "How much do I owe you?"
"Nothing."
He minced away. At the corner, he turned around.
"Get it and leave it somewhere where your wife can find it. Don't talk to her about it. She knows. She's wonderful."
"Helen," I said to her, "what does all this mean? You are sick. Why won't you tell me about it?"
"Don't torture me," she replied very feebly. "Let me live on in my own way."
"You don't want to talk about it?" She shook her head.
"There's nothing to talk about."
"Isn't there anything I can do to help you?"
"No, dearest," she said. "This time you can't help me. If you could, I'd tell you so."
"I still have the little Degas. I can sell it here. There are rich people in Biarritz. It will bring in enough money to put you in a hospital."
"And have me arrested? Besides, it wouldn't do any good, believe me."
"Is it as bad as all that?" The look in her eyes was so harried and miserable that I asked her no more. I decided to drop in on Dubois and ask him again. Schwartz fell silent. "Did she have cancer?" I asked. He nodded. I should have suspected it long before. In Switzerland, they had told her that she could be operated on again, but that it would do no good. She had had one operation. That was the scar I had seen. The specialist had told her the truth. She could choose between a few more useless operations that would keep her permanently in the hospital and a short life outside. He had also told her that there was no assurance that she would live any longer in the hospital. She had decided against the operations.
She didn't want to tell you?
No. She hated her sickness. She tried to ignore it. She felt soiled, as though worms were crawling around inside her. She had the feeling that the disease was a kind of jellyfish, living and growing inside her. She thought I would be repelled if I knew about it. Perhaps she even hoped to make her cancer go away by ignoring it.
And you never spoke to her about it?
Very little. She spoke to Dubois, and later on I made Dubois tell me the truth. He gave me more drugs. He told me the pain would increase, but it was also possible, he said, that the end would be quick and merciful. I didn't speak of it to Helen. She didn't want me to. She threatened to kill herself if I didn't leave her alone. After that, I pretended to believe her, to believe that it was harmless cramps. We had to leave Biarritz. We deceived each other. Helen watched me, and I watched her, but soon the deception acquired a strange power. First, it destroyed what I feared most, the notion of time. The notion of weeks and months faded away. It still terrified us to think how little time we had ahead of us, but our fear became as transparent as glass. It was no longer a cloud over our days. It became a shield that deflected all disturbing thoughts. They simply couldn't come in. I had my fits of despair when Helen was asleep. I stared at her face as she lay there, breathing gently, and at my sound hands, and I understood the terrible forlornness that our skin imposes on us, the gulf that can never be bridged. My healthy blood was powerless to cure the sick blood of my beloved. That was beyond understanding. And so is death. The moment became everything. Tomorrow was an eternity away. When Helen woke up, the day began, and when she slept and I felt her beside me, my thoughts hovered between hope and despair. I hatched fantastic plans based on miracles, or dreamed up a philosophy of the moment, blind to everything else. But all my fantasies were dispelled by the early light, swallowed up in the morning mists. The weather turned cold. I went about with a Degas. It should have brought in the fare to America, and I would have been glad to sell it, but there was no one willing to pay a reasonable price in the small towns and villages we passed through. Here and there we worked. I learned to work in the fields. I dug and hoed. I was glad to be busy. We were not the only ones. I saw professors sawing wood and opera singers hoeing beets. The peasants behaved like peasants. They took advantage of the cheap labor. Some paid a little, others provided food and a place to spend the night, and some chased you away. So we made our way to Marseille. Have you been there?
Who hasn't? I said.
It was the hunting ground of the gendarmes and the Gestapo. They rounded up the refugees like rabbits outside the consulates.
They almost caught us, said Schwartz.
The prefect in charge of the Service d'Estrange in Marseille did everything in his power to save the refugees. I was still possessed by the idea of getting an American visa. An American visa, it seemed to me, might even arrest cancer. To get a visa, you know all that, you had to prove that you were in extreme danger, or you had to be on a list of well-known artists, scientists, or intellectuals that was drawn up in America. As if the whole lot of us weren't in danger, and as if man didn't equal man. Doesn't the distinction between ordinary and valuable men smack a little of the Nazi concept of the superman as opposed to subhuman vermin? They can't take everybody, I said.
No,
Schwartz retorted. I did not answer. What answer was there? Yes and no were the same. Why not the most dispossessed? Schwartz asked. Those without a name and fame. Again I said nothing. Schwartz had 2 American visas. What more did he want? Didn't he know that the Americans gave anyone a visa provided someone over there made out an affidavit guaranteeing that he would not become a public charge? He said as much the next moment. I don't know a soul over there, but someone gave me an address in New York. I wrote a letter. I wrote to other people, too. I described our situation. Then a friend told me that I had gone about it all wrong. Invalids were not admitted to the United States. Incurables were not even considered. I would have to say that Helen was in perfect health. Helen had overheard a part of the conversation. That was inevitable. No one spoke of anything else in Marseille. It was like a swarm of bees gone mad. That evening we were sitting in a restaurant off the Cambier. The wind swept through the streets. I was not discouraged. I hoped to find a humane doctor who would give Helen a health certificate. We were still playing the same game, pretending to believe each other, pretending that I knew nothing. I had written to the prefect of her camp for an attestation that we were endangered. We had found a small room. I had obtained a residence permit for 1 week and was working nights illegally in a restaurant as a dishwasher. We had some money, and a druggist had given me 10 ampules of morphine on Dubois' prescription. So for the moment, we had everything we needed. We sat at a table by the window looking out at the street. For us, a rare luxury. For a whole week, there was no need to hide. Suddenly, Helen gave a start and grasped my hand. She was staring into the windy darkness. Georg, she whispered. Where?
In that open car. He just drove by.
Are you sure? She nodded. It struck me as next to impossible. I made several attempts to distinguish the features of people in passing cars and found that I couldn't. But I was not reassured. Why should he be in Marseille, of all places? I asked. But the next instant I realized that Marseille was the most natural place in the world for him to be, the last haven of all the refugees in France. We'll have to leave Marseille, I said.
Where can we go?
Spain.
Isn't that even more dangerous?
There were rumors that the Gestapo had made itself at home in Spain, and that refugees had been arrested by the Spanish police and turned over to the German authorities. But all sorts of rumors were going around in those days. You couldn't believe them all. I had another try at the old rat race. The Spanish transit visa, which was granted only if you had a Portuguese visa, which in turn was contingent on a visa for some other country. Not to mention the worst bureaucratic chicanery of all, the French exit visa. One night we had a stroke of luck. A young American spoke to us. He was a little tipsy and was looking for someone to talk English to. A few minutes later he was sitting at our table buying us drinks. He was about 25 and was waiting for a ship to take him back to America. Why don't you come along? He asked. I said nothing for a moment. The naive question seemed to open a rift in the table between us. He was living on another planet. What for him was as natural as a drink of water was for us as inaccessible as the Pleiades. No visas, I said finally.
That's no obstacle. We have a consulate here in Marseille. Real nice people.
I knew the nice people. They were demigods. You waited for hours in the street just to see their secretaries. Later we were allowed to wait in the cellar because refugees were often picked up in the street by Gestapo agents.
I'll take you there tomorrow, said the American.
Fine, I said, not believing him for one moment.
Let's drink on it.
We drank. His fresh, guileless face was almost more than I could bear. He told us about the sea of lights on Broadway, fairy tales in a dark city. I watched Helen's face as he dropped the names of actors, plays, nightclubs, as he evoked the innocent hubbub of a city that had never known a war. I was wretched, and at the same time, glad to see that she was listening, because up until then she had received every mention of America with a strange silent lethargy. Her face lit up. She smiled through the cigarette smoke and promised to let the man take her to see his favorite play. We drank and knew that the whole thing would be forgotten the next day. We were mistaken. The young American called for us at 10 o'clock sharp. I had a hangover and Helen refused to go along. It was raining. The usual knot of refugees had formed outside the consulate. It was like a dream. The crowd parted before us as the Red Sea parted before the Jews fleeing from Pharaoh. The American's green passport was the golden key that opened all doors. The incredible happened. When the situation was explained to the young man, he announced very nonchalantly that he would vouch for us. It sounded preposterous. He was so young. It seemed to me that to vouch for me, he'd have had to be older than I. We spent about an hour at the consulate. Some weeks before, I had filed a statement explaining why we were in danger. Through intermediaries in Switzerland, it had cost me no end of trouble. I had obtained letters proving that I had been in a German concentration camp. I had also presented proof that Georg was looking for both of us to take us back to Germany. I was told to come back in a week. Outside, the American shook hands with me. "It's been swell meeting you. Here." He produced a visiting card. "Call me up when you get there." He waved his hand and was about to leave. "But what if something goes wrong? What if I need you?" I asked. "What can go wrong? It's all settled." He laughed. "My father's pretty well known. I've heard there's a boat going to Oran tomorrow. I think I'll shoot over there before I go back. Who knows when I'll be here again? Better see as much as I can right now." He vanished. Half a dozen refugees surrounded me, asking for his name and address. They guessed what had happened and wanted to get in on it. When I told them I didn't know where he was staying in Marseille, they called me some very unflattering names. I actually didn't know. I showed them the card with his American address. They wrote it down. I told them it would do no good. The man was going to Oran. They said they'd wait for him on the dock before his boat left. I started home with mixed feelings. Maybe I had ruined everything by showing his card, but bewilderment had destroyed my presence of mind. And anyway, as I became more convinced at every step, the whole situation was hopeless. I told Helen all about it. She smiled. She was very gentle that evening. We had sublet our little room from a subtenant, you know, about those addresses that pass from mouth to mouth. The green canary we had promised to take care of was singing like mad in his wire cage. He never stopped. Now and then a cat would step in from the nearby roofs and sit in the window, devouring the bird with its yellow eyes. It was cold, but Helen wanted the windows open. She always did when she was in pain. The house didn't quiet down until very late. "Do you remember the little chateau?" Helen asked. "I remember as if someone had told me about it," I said, "as if it weren't myself, but someone else who had been there." She looked at me. "Maybe that's how it is," she said. "Everyone has several people inside him, all different, and sometimes one of them becomes independent and takes over for a while. Then you become somebody else, somebody you'd never known. But we come back." She turned to me with an air of urgency. "Don't we?" "I never had different people inside me," I said. "I've always been monotonously the same." She shook her head violently. "You're wrong. Some day you'll find out.
What do you mean?
Forget it. Look at that cat in the window, and that silly bird, so unsuspecting, the jubilant victim.
The cat will never get him. He's safe in his cage. Helen burst out laughing.
Safe in his cage, she repeated. Who wants to be safe in a cage?
We awoke toward morning. The concierge was screaming and cursing. Fully dressed and ready to run for it, I opened the door, but there was no sign of police.
The blood! The woman screamed. Couldn't she do it some other way? What a mess! And now we'll have the police. That's what comes of having a kind heart. People take advantage. And the 5 weeks' rent she owes me!
The other tenants had gathered in the gray light of the hallway and were staring into the room next to ours. A woman of 60 had committed suicide by cutting the veins of one wrist. The blood had run down the side of her bed.
Get a doctor, said Lachman, a refugee from Frankfurt, who made his living in Marseille selling rosaries and pictures of saints.
A doctor! Fumed the concierge. She's been dead for hours, can't you see that? That's what comes of taking you people in. Now we'll have the police. They can arrest the lot of you for all I care. And the bed. How will I ever get it clean?
We'll clean it up, said Lachman. But don't bring the police into it.
And her rent? What about her rent?
We'll take up a collection, said an old woman in a red kimono. Where else can we go? Take pity on us.
I took pity on her, and she took advantage. If at least she had any valuables.
The concierge rummaged about. The one naked bulb gave off a pale yellow light. Under the bed there was a cheap fiber suitcase. The concierge knelt down at the end of the iron bed, the end with no blood on it, and pulled it out. Under her striped house dress she presented the posterior of a great obscene insect pouncing on its prey. She opened the suitcase.
Nothing! Rags, old shoes!
Look here, said the old woman in the red kimono, pointing at a little box. Her name was Lucy Lowe. She sold discard stockings on the black market and mended broken china. The concierge opened the box. On a bed of pink cotton lay a small chain and a ring with a little stone in it.
Gold?
Asked the concierge. Must be plated.
Gold, said Lachman.
If it were gold, said the concierge, she'd have sold it before doing what she did.
It's not always hunger that makes you do those things, said Lachman calmly. It's gold, all right, and the stone is a ruby, worth at least 700 or 800 francs.
Don't make me laugh.
I can sell it for you if you like.
And swindle me, eh? Oh, no, my friend, you've come to the wrong address.
She had to call the police. There was no getting around it. Meanwhile, the refugee tenants disappeared. Most of them started on their daily activities, waiting at the consulates or trying to sell something or looking for work. The rest of us went to the nearest church. We posted a lookout on the corner to tell us when the coast was clear. Churches were safe. Mass was being said. In the aisles sat women in black dresses, stooped over like dark hillocks. The candles burned impassively, the organ played, and the light glittered on the upraised golden chalice which contained the blood of Christ, who with it had redeemed the world. What had it led to? To bloody crusades, religious fanaticism, the tortures of the Inquisition, witch hunts, and the burning of heretics, all in the name of charity.
Why don't we go to the railroad station? I asked Helen. It's warmer.
All right, but just wait a moment.
She went to a pew below the pulpit and knelt down. I don't know whether she prayed and to whom, but I thought of the day when I had waited for her in the cathedral in Osnabrück. I had found a woman whom I had not known, and who from day to day had grown stranger to me, yet closer. Now she seemed to be slipping away from me again,
into a realm where all names are forgotten, where there is only darkness, and perhaps certain unknown laws of darkness. She rejected that dark realm. She came back, but she no longer belonged to me as I had tried to believe. Perhaps she had never belonged to me. Who, after all, belongs to whom? And what is it to belong to someone, to belong to one another? Isn't it a forlorn illusion, a convention? Again she turned back, as she called it, for an hour, for the duration of a glance, for a night. And always I felt like a bookkeeper who is not allowed to audit. I could only accept without question whatever this unaccountable, unhappy, damned, and beloved creature chose to be and to tell me. I know there are other names for it, cheap, easy, disparaging names, but they are for other circumstances, and for people who mistake their selfish desires for votive tablets. Loneliness demands a companion and does not ask who it is. If you don't know that, you may have been alone, but you were never lonely. What did you pray for? I asked, and was sorry I had asked. She gave me a strange look. For an American visa, she answered, and I knew she was lying. Maybe the exact opposite. I thought for a moment. I had often been struck by her passive resistance to my American projects. America, she had said one night. What will you do in America? Why run so far? When you get there, there will be some other America to run to, and then another. Don't you see that? She wanted no more changes. She had abandoned all belief in a future. The death that was consuming her had no wish to run away. It governed her like a vivisectionist who looks on to see what will happen when one organ, and then another, one cell, and then another, is modified and destroyed. It played a cruel game of masks with her, not so very different from our innocent masquerade at the castle. From one minute to the next, this woman, looking at me out of tremulous eyes, could be all hatred for me or all devotion. At times she was a gambler, losing with heart-breaking courage, and at times she was all hunger and desperation. But always she was a human being who had nothing but me to return to from out of the darkness, and who was grateful for that in her last brave, frightened tremor. Our lookout came in to announce that the police had gone. "We should have gone to the museum," said Lockman. "It's heated." "Is there one here?" asked a hunchbacked young woman, whose husband had been taken away by the police and who had been waiting for him for 6 weeks.
"Of course."
I couldn't help thinking of old Schwartz. "Would you like to go?" I asked Helen.
"Not now. Let's go back."
I didn't want her to see the dead woman again, but she insisted. The concierge had calmed down when we got back. Perhaps she had had the chain and the ring appraised.
"Poor woman," she said. "Now she hasn't even got a name."
Had she no papers?
"She had a sauve-conduit. The others drew lots for it before the police came. The little redhead won."
"That's good. She had no papers at all. I'm sure the dead woman wouldn't have minded."
"Would you like to see her?"
"No," I said.
"Yes," said Helen.
I went with her. The dead woman had stopped bleeding. When we came in, two refugee women were washing the body. They turned it over like a white plank. The hair hung down to the floor.
"Get out!"
one of them hissed at me. I went. Helen stayed. A little while later, I came back to get her. She was standing alone in the narrow room at the foot of the bed, staring at the white, sunken face, in which one eye was not quite closed. "Come now," I said.
"So that's how one looks," she whispered. "Where will they bury her?"
"I don't know. Where the poor are buried. If there's a charge, the concierge will take up a collection." Helen did not answer.
cold air blew in through the open window.
"When will she be buried?" she asked.
"Tomorrow or the day after. Maybe they'll want to do an autopsy."
"Why, won't they believe it was suicide?"
"Oh, I guess they will." The concierge came in.
"They're taking her to a hospital tomorrow for an autopsy. That's how the young doctors learn to operate. It makes no difference to her, and that way it's free of charge. Would you care for a cup of coffee?"
"No,"
said Helen.
"I need one," said the concierge. "I'm all upset, though I don't see why. We've all got to go someday."
"Yes," said Helen, "but no one wants to believe it."
I awoke in the middle of the night. She was sitting up in bed and seemed to be listening.
"Do you smell it too?" she asked.
"What?"
"The corpse. I smell it. Close the window."
"There isn't any smell, Helen. It doesn't happen so quickly."
"I do smell it."
"Maybe it's the leaves." The rumors had set some laurel boughs and a candle by the deathbed.
"What's the good of that?" Helen asked. "Tomorrow she'll be dissected. When they're through, they'll toss the pieces in a bucket and sell them to the zoo."
"They won't sell anything," I said. "After the autopsy, the body will be cremated or buried." I tried to put my arms around Helen's shoulders, but she pushed me away.
"I don't want to be cut up," she said.
"Why should you be cut up?" She didn't hear me.
"Promise not to let them cut me up."
"I promise."
"Close the window. I smell it again."
I got up and closed the window. The moon was bright, and the cat was sitting on the sill. It hissed and jumped away when the window grazed it.
"What was that?" Helen asked behind me.
"The cat."
"See, she smelled it too."
I turned around. "She sits here every night waiting for the canary to come out of the cage." "Go back to sleep, Helen. You've been dreaming. Really, there's no smell coming from her room."
"Then it must be me."
I stared at her. "Nobody smells, Helen. You've been dreaming."
"If it's not the corpse, it must be me."
"Stop lying," she replied angrily. "Good Lord, Helen, nobody smells. If there's any smell, it's garlic from the restaurant downstairs. Here." I took a little bottle of cologne, one of the articles I was selling on the black market, and sprinkled a few drops on the bed. "See, now everything smells fine." She was still sitting bolt upright.
"So you admit it," she said, "or you wouldn't have sprinkled the cologne."
"I don't admit anything. I did it to comfort you."
"I know what you think," she said. "You think I smell like the corpse. Don't lie. I can see it by the way you look at me. I've seen it for weeks. Do you think I don't notice how you look at me when you think I'm not looking? I know that I disgust you. I know it. I see it. I can feel it every day. I know what you think. You don't believe what the doctors say. You think I've got something else, and you think you can smell it. I disgust you. Why don't you admit it?"
I stood perfectly still. If she had more to say, let her say it. But she stopped. I could feel that she was trembling. Propped up on her arms, she was leaning forward, a pale, indistinct shape. Her eyes were too big for their sockets, and her lips were heavily made up. She had taken to putting on makeup before going to bed. She glared at me like a wounded animal, ready to spring at my throat. It was a long time before she calmed down. In the end, I knocked on Baum's door on the second floor and bought a flask of cognac from him. We sat on the bed drinking and waited for morning. The men came early for the body. We heard their heavy boots on the stairs, and the stretcher bumped, colliding with the walls of the narrow hallway. Their jokes could be heard indistinctly through the thin partition. An hour later, the new roomers moved in.